Welcome to Sweet Tea and Strategy, a podcast by Ackerman Marketing and PR, featuring business and community leaders throughout Tennessee, talking about issues and trends of importance to our state and beyond, and sharing some of their very best sweet tea recipes and tea sipping stories. I'm Kathy Ackerman, and I'm so pleased to welcome Dr. Lynn Massengill, co-founder of Team Health, as our guest today on Sweet Tea and Strategy. We're excited to talk with you about Team Health's amazing corporate journey, Lynn. But before we dig into that, let's talk just a little bit about sweet tea.
Okay.
And first of all, are you even a fan? Did you grow up drinking it? You're a child of the South, maybe, so I'm assuming that you had some sweet tea in your life?
Yeah, about 3 cups of sugar per gallon.
Well, there you go.
That's my mom's recipe, I think.
So that's your recipe. Any favorite places that you've traveled that have amazing sweet tea?
You know, my mom died this year, so that was my favorite place. Other than that, everything. A distant second.
For sure. Very good. Well, let's jump in and let our listeners have a good grounding to begin with into some facts and figures about Team Health. If you could just trace us through real quickly when the company was founded and what was your initial business premise for starting it, just sort of trace us through the evolution and growth of Team Health over the years to become the very significant national player that it is today.
Well, first, thanks for the kind comments and for doing this.
Absolutely.
We started here literally 40 years ago in 1979, and then we got our first contract that started the January 1st of 1980, and we started at UT Hospital and what at that time was called Sevier Medical Center, which is now LeCont, the Covenant facility in Sevierville. And that was 100% of the plan. Prior to that, in most hospitals in the country, there were no such thing as full-time emergency room doctors or ER doctors. The emergency department was staffed by nurses, and they would call in doctors as needed. And up in Michigan, some doctors a few years before 1979 started working full-time in the ER. UT Hospital had some ER doctors, and I worked there some for the group that had the contract. But in general, most hospitals in East Tennessee either didn't have coverage except by the medical staff, or they had coverage that was suboptimal in their mind one way or another. So Dr. John Minchin and I started the group, and we contracted with UT and what's now LeCod, and pleased to say 40 years later, they're still our clients, so we're delighted about that. And within the first year, other hospitals in the region started calling and said, we need this kind of service, and would you come talk to us? And we did. So we drew a 2-hour circle in the car.
Right.
And that became the universe to get in front of a problem or an opportunity. And we did that for 10 years.
Wow.
We worked 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. for 7 days. Then we'd be off for 7 days. Then we'd work 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. for 7 days and then be off for 7 days. So you worked 84 hours every other week in the ER, and that gave us 2 full weeks a month to go work on the business. And in those days, I could make do on 4 hours sleep a night. So the week
days,
of nights,
right?
I had about half a day. So we went out and talked to hospitals and recruited doctors and paid the bills, and we did that for 10 years. And at the end of 10 years, we did a couple of things. We recruited Mike Hatcher, a CPA MBA,
right,
to be our first non-physician executive and partner.
Mm-hmm.
And we drew a 2-hour circle in the car, drew a 2-hour circle in a 37-year-old single engine airplane. And that became the universe for 5 years.
And were you still practicing medicine?
Still practicing,
at that time?
Yes, mm-hmm. Working in all the ERs. In about the second year, Randall Dabbs joined us, Dr. Dabbs. And then about the fourth year, we merged with a local competitor group run by Dr. John Staley.
Right.
So it was the four of us and Mike for several years. And then so we did that for a total of 15 years. And then we decided to try to do it nationally, which we've now done for 25 years.
And that was a huge step.
Big step. Each one of those was big steps for us.
So when you decided to go national, what were the primary challenges?
Well, the driver was that there was a big change in payment for all physician services in the mid-90s, and that was a move from fee-for-service to capitation.
Right.
And doctors all over the country were scared about that, and they didn't understand it. It basically put the financial risk of care into doctors' practices, which most were not prepared for. So we went around the country, met with lots of good groups that, if we flattered ourselves, we thought they looked like us. They were doing good clinical work and they had good business practices. And our idea was that each of us was probably doing something better than the other one of us.
Right.
And the goal was to pick each other's best practices clinically and administratively and then to combine them all over the country. And in about 5 years, we did that, and we grew about sevenfold in 5 years.
That kind of growth is impressive but difficult.
It's difficult.
What were the biggest challenges in the growth part?
You know, I think the challenges were two or three things. One was picking partners that you really felt at the end of the day were the right kind of people, that they had the right ethical perspective, that they knew that I know it's a cliche, but taking care of the patient is job one. You know, if you don't get that right, nothing else matters. And we've often said here that the interaction between a team health physician or a team health clinician, doctor, nurse practitioner, PA, CRNA, and a patient and a family and an attending doctor on the medical staff at 2 o'clock in the morning is what it's all about. So all those groups were high quality groups, and they were ethical people. And that was the first step.
So you were growing people. By acquisition.
Growing by acquisition, point, right. And then growing those groups again organically after the acquisition. So right. I think the biggest challenges were picking the right partners, and then second, picking the right best practices among those new partners to roll out among all of us as partners. And then I think the last thing was to simply try to maintain what we at least thought was the right culture as we brought more and more people into the fold. And so those were the hard things. The hard things weren't how do you practice good medicine or how do you get the bill out properly. It was more how do you maintain this culture that we thought we had and that they had, in fairness, even, no matter where they were.
So how would you describe that culture?
Yeah, I think the culture is grounded on a whole lot of things. I think it's grounded on, again, first and foremost, it's about the patient care. And I don't care how smart you are or anything else. If you can't get that right, then, you know, the game's over.
Right.
That's the first thing. Second thing is I think there's a pretty high dose of humility here. We don't think we have anything figured out, and we're trying to improve it every day. And there's not a lot of big egos at Team Health, I don't think, anywhere in the country. And I think that's a core part of who we are. I think there's a real strong sense of fair play, and all the cliche things about all the things I learned in life I learned in kindergarten.
Right.
All those things about how to treat people. And then I guess the last thing is just that there were periods where we could take on more growth, mm-hmm. and there were periods where we just couldn't. We mm-hmm. just had taken on all we could, and we just needed to push the pause button.
And you knew when to do that.
And having the discipline to do that. Mm-hmm. Now, we certainly made lots of mistakes. We had lots of mistakes. But those were the core things, I think.
So how large are you today in terms of number of employees, number of practices, number of states that you're in?
Yeah, we're the second or third largest physician group in the United States. Now, there are about 12,000 doctors.
Not just emergency
physicians, mm-hmm. hospitalists, anesthesiologists, some general surgeons, some orthopedists, some laborists, a lot of primary care physicians. And then another 6,000 nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and certified registered nurse anesthetists, CRNAs.
Mm-hmm.
So about 18,000 of those folks and about 3,500 administrative team members in 47 states. And this year we'll see about 28 million patients.
Are you international?
We are not. We are in 47 contiguous states, but we're also 45 contiguous states, but we also are in Alaska and Hawaii, but nothing beyond that.
Right, right. So what about the business side of the business? Because you've been through some interesting, I think, iterations in terms of who you have become today as a publicly traded company and all that entails.
Yeah, well, I think probably the best thing that happened about that early on was very early. One of our hospitals was St. Mary's here in town, and that was now Tenova. And one of the sisters there, who at that time was running the hospital, I went to her to talk about a little raise for the doctors. And I was very nervous, and she knew I was nervous, and she put her hand on my arm, and she said what I guess may be a cliche in their world, but I'd never heard it before. She said, Dr. Maskell, there is no mission. If there is no money, it's okay to talk about the money sometimes. Let's talk about the money.
Perfect.
And
yes.
So we talk about that here some in a way that says if we're going to be about this, if we're going to recruit the best doctors, make sure they have the best tools, if we can perfect the practice of medicine as much as possible mm-hmm. by helping them, by staying out of their way when we should and providing tools when we can, that you have to be able to do that. You have to fund that. So we do try to have good business practices. We try to be ethical about that. We have a really strong corporate compliance program,
mm-hmm.
and we have outside board members who help us make sure we're keeping our nose to the grindstone about compliance. If we're not doing it on our own, they'll help us do that. And so we have very strong business people on our team and very strong doctor leaders. And I've said for a long time, we have clinicians who can read income statements and balance sheets, and we have business people who really understand quality of care and care a lot about that.
Perfect.
So
Perfect.
That's really what it's all about. Leif Murphy is our CEO now. I serve as chairman, and Leif talks about five things in particular. He talks about quality and patient safety. He talks about clinician engagement and retention. He talks about metric-driven operational excellence, which is a euphemism for you have to have some math to support a position, not just a hunch.
Right.
And as physicians and scientists, that's okay with us. Contract retention and growth. Those are the five things. But those first two, quality and patient safety and clinician engagement and retention, that's really, those are the core mantras. And we have lots of metrics around those things.
So what is your vision for the future? Where do you see the company in 5 years?
Yeah, you know, we're going through a challenging time right now where some of the payers have unilaterally reduced reimbursement to us. So we're having to figure out how to adapt to that and combat that if we can, because emergency physicians, emergency medicine is still about 3/4 of what we do. And if you take all the patients that come in the hospital emergency department, we are by federal law obligated to take care of every patient regardless of their ability to pay. And in fact, we can't even ask their ability to pay until we've done an assessment and stabilized any emergency. So we're seeing all sorts of patients. About 20% of our patients have no insurance, no Medicare, no Medicaid.
Right.
They are either homeless or they're unemployed or uninsured for some other reason. So for Medicare patients, Medicaid patients, and those patients with no insurance of any kind, we actually pay the clinicians more than we collect. The doctors don't get paid based on the payer status. A patient brought from under the bridge and a patient brought from the bank president's office are treated the same way by the doctors,
right,
which is the way everybody thinks it ought to be. But in terms of the business model, we have to get a higher than average rate from the commercial payers to offset those. And right now, that's a challenge. So we're going through some challenging times with the payers. And then there's some federal legislation that we're dealing with that has to do with surprise billing, which is a very legitimate issue without a real simple solution.
Define that.
Yeah.
That's a word that's being talked about a lot these days, and I think people mostly don't understand what that means.
Yeah, it's a really important topic. And I think in the way that we would all agree that it means the following, and that is that if you have a insurance card from pick a company, Blue Cross, and it says that Hospital X is in network, and you go there for an emergency or an operation, and if the doctor doesn't have a contract with Blue Cross, you could get a bill for the full charge.
Right.
Whereas if we did have a contract, we might get paid half of that or 3/4 of that, a meaningful discount.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing that we'd all agree with is that's terrible.
Yes.
The patient should not have to figure that out in the heat of the moment with
or
an emergency.
Or
be worried about it.
Right.
That's exactly right. So we agree that that ought not be the case.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is really two things. One is we don't believe that the payers should unilaterally set the rate they pay us. That they should just unilaterally say it's worth X.
Right.
We think there should be a way to negotiate that, which has always been true. And then the second thing is that over the last several years, as deductibles and copays have grown and grown and grown and grown.
Dramatically.
Mm-hmm. More and more patients have a deductible that might easily be $5,000 or $6,000 or $10,000.
Right.
A decision that they or their employer made.
Right.
And so they'll get a bill from us in the hospital that's for a lot, and they're shocked.
Mm-hmm.
They're surprised by that bill.
Right.
And what we found is that in our situation, at least 9 out of 10 patients who get what they are surprised by as a bill is about the deductible or the copay.
Interesting.
Not about our being out of network. We've chosen in almost every place to be in network.
Right.
And we have a few places where we aren't. And when we aren't, our position is that we won't balance bill the patient.
Mm-hmm.
But we're in a meaningful dispute with the payers about it. But the thing we all agree on, surprise billing needs to go away. Nobody should have to worry about it. We're just fighting over the mechanism to determine the rate.
So do you have any thoughts on that mechanism?
Well, we think that it ought to be set on something other than just what either one of us says.
Right.
The insurance company shouldn't have to pay us whatever we want, and we shouldn't have to take whatever they offer.
Exactly.
That's just not the way life is. So what we think is that there ought to be some objective benchmark by some third party.
Mm-hmm.
There are different third parties. There's an entity called Fair Health,
right,
and that's kind of the average of the in-network and out-of-network folks.
Yes.
There's some other language called commercially reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly does commercially reasonable mean? And there's some debate about that. And then the last thing is that we think that we ought to have the ability to arbitrate if we disagree.
Mm-hmm.
There ought to be a mechanism for us to have a friendly spat we and the payer, we and the insurance company, not we and the patient. And so that's what we think is right. The payers don't want there to be arbitration.
Right.
And they want to set the rate.
So do you see us moving in a direction that's going to lead to a positive outcome along these lines?
I think it has to get resolved, right?
Right.
One way or another, it'll get resolved. And it'll get resolved, I think, in the next few months.
So what do patients need to know? I mean, patients as consumers of healthcare, I think, are confused. They're frightened. There's a lot of movement within that world that they don't understand. What do they need to understand first and foremost when they, especially when they walk into an emergency room?
Well, I think about that in terms of my own family. And, you know, I have adult children and I have young adult grandchildren. So what I think they ought to know is several things. First of all, everybody should have a primary care doctor.
Right.
And that primary care doctor ought to be the first line of defense and the first line of offense.
Right.
You know, regularly seeing your primary care physician. And when I say that, I generally mean family practice, internal medicine, pediatrics, or OBGYN. The OBGYN docs provide a ton of primary care services to their patients, way more than just obstetric and gynecologic things. Women tend to utilize their OBGYNs for lots of things. So we tend to think of that them as providing a lot of primary care. So first of all, you need a primary care doctor. And that's both to prevent a problem that drives you to the ER, and if you have a moment of question where, do I need to go to the ER or not? Now, if you're having the worst headache of your life and you've never had it before, you need to go to the ER. You might be having an aneurysm.
Right.
If you're having crushing chest pain that's going down your left arm and you're short of breath and nauseated,
right,
you need to call an ambulance to go to the hospital. On the other hand, if you've had abdominal pain for 4 hours and it's kind of funny and vague and I'm a little queasy, that's probably a call to your primary care doctor to say, hey, what do you think about this and where should I go? And they might direct you to their office or their own urgent care or to the ER. So that, to me, is that we're all about the critical role of the primary care doctor.
What's the percentage of the population that you think has a primary care doctor?
Well, there's two answers to that. Today, apparently, only about half the people in the country have a primary care doctor, is what I would guess. And the bigger issue is, can you get in to see them?
Yes.
They're all booked up.
Yes.
They're all busy.
Mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, most of them are underpaid.
Mm-hmm.
There's not great reimbursement, especially for pediatrics, and not great for some of the other primary care specialties. So the reality is, it's very hard to get in to see your primary care doctor in a lot of practices, even if you have one.
So what about urgent care? What role do they play, should they play?
Yeah, we think urgent care plays a legitimate role, and I think the challenge is knowing exactly what you're seeing. I think in a perfect world, if you go to urgent care, you go to one that has the same provider each time you go.
Right.
It's somebody
so
you come
some
to
continuity.
Know. They kind of become the surrogate primary care doctor a little bit. I think the problem with urgent care, and we run some urgent care centers for hospitals, and the problem with what we would call retail medicine, like nurse practitioners and PAs in drugstores, is in our experience, the variability in the caregiver is extreme.
I bet.
In terms of experience and training, and I think it's way more of a crapshoot.
So would your company run that department for a Walgreens,
instance? We have done a little bit of that on a trial basis. Mostly what we do is we staff some urgent care clinics for our hospital customers. We own literally a handful of urgent care clinics, literally maybe two hands full. But we staff quite a few for hospitals because a lot of hospitals have them.
Absolutely.
And those, in my opinion, are generally the better ones because you have a lot of the same oversight that you do at the hospital that you don't have in every location.
What about telemedicine?
You know, we all believe that there's a future for telemedicine, and it has some great roles. The problem with telemedicine, of course, is that it's mostly not paid for by anybody.
Right.
That's the problem.
Right.
So my daughter in Nashville, who has two little children, she would 100-to-1 rather pick up her phone, talk to her nurse practitioner about her child, who has something that she knows what they have anyway, and she knows what they need.
Yes.
She'd rather do that, and she'd pay more for that than to have to leave work and go down there.
And wait in a waiting
room. And wait with other sick people.
Right.
So that's a good use of telemedicine, I think, in some circumstances, particularly for the known patient. And the other great use of it is what I would call the partial full-time equivalent need. If you're a rural hospital that can't afford a radiologist who reads knee MRIs, but you need a knee MRI read, the ability to send that by telemedicine to a person who's reading 100 knee MRIs today
is
perfect.
Beneficial.
It's terrific.
Absolutely.
But in general, it has never been very well reimbursed. and that may change over time. We think there's a great set of roles for it, but we have a couple of sites now where we're staffing rural emergency departments with very experienced nurse practitioners or PAs, but with a doctor on the other end of a phone or a video or a video connection.
Mm-hmm. So does it concern you that so many rural hospitals are closing?
It's a terrible thing. And, you know, it's happening all over the country, as you know, and it's happening for a lot of different reasons. I do think that if you go back to the Affordable Care Act, which in my opinion had some terrific features and it had some less than terrific features, among the things that occurred in the Affordable Care Act was a declining rate of increases for hospitals from Medicare.
Right.
So rural hospitals, all hospitals have had a squeeze on Medicare reimbursement. The theory was that that would be offset by universal coverage,
right,
that everybody would have coverage. So in states that didn't expand Medicaid, those hospitals are all getting the Medicare squeeze, but they're not getting the lift from expanded Medicaid.
Right.
For the record, I vote both sides of the ticket. I vote for Democrats and Republicans. I don't vilify or love either one, but I do think that expansion of Medicaid in states is in fact the best thing for the population and the way to lower costs, not increase costs. Mm-hmm.
What about recruiting doctors? Is that becoming harder?
It's a big deal. We recruit about 1,000 new doctors a year.
Wow.
So it's a big part of what we do. And as important as recruiting is, it's retention. Mm-hmm. All these doctors are in short supply. They all have lots of options about places to go work. And so we try to make sure that we're providing the best possible opportunity we can. We talk a lot about perfecting the practice of medicine, and we try to do that as best we can. And we do a lot, and I think they would say that, and they help us figure out what we need to do. So we have a big recruiting team. We start a lot of that when they're in training. We have a residency recruiting team who, not surprisingly, mostly happen to be young people because the residents are mostly young.
Yes.
And then we have lots of other recruiters who are recruiting doctors who are moving from one place to another or who might be open to considering a move. So it's really the lifeblood of what we do is recruiting and retaining doctors, nurse practitioners, PAs, and CRAs.
So what kind of person wants to go into emergency management? Yeah. How would you describe that person?
Yeah, in terms of the practice of emergency medicine, I think it used to be somebody like me, and now it's different. When I went to medical school, I went to medical school wanting to be my family doctor.
Right.
I wanted to be Herb Whittle. But I did an ER rotation and absolutely fell in love with it. I fell in love with the adrenaline. I fell in love with the intensity. I fell in love with the lack of sleep. But there's enough going on there in terms of excitement that's what I wanted to do. So now I think that's still a big driver. But the other big driver now is that from a lifestyle standpoint, it's a pretty good gig.
Yes.
In that your life is completely scheduled.
Mm-hmm.
When you are off, you are off.
Mm-hmm.
You never have to go back to work. You're never on call unless you've agreed to be on backup call. We have some places that we have backup call if it gets frantically busy. But in general, you can work 12 to 14 12-hour days and have 16 to 18 days a month off.
Which is really appealing to a lot of people.
It's very appealing to a lot of people. The downside is about half your time is after 5 o'clock, because that's just the way the calendar is.
Right.
And you work about every other weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to coach a Little League baseball team.
Right.
It's hard to teach a Sunday school class.
Mm-hmm.
There's some trade-offs for that. But particularly for a person who wants to have scheduled time off, it's a terrific profession for women because of that. And
right.
We have a lot of female emergency physicians, a lot of female anesthesiologists, a lot of female hospitalists.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that you want to tell our listeners? This is such a huge and important world that we're talking about right now. It affects everyone. Is there anything else that you want people to know about the changing world that you live and breathe in?
That's a long, complicated question, but I guess there's two or three things. It's, you know, it's easy to be pessimistic right now about a lot of things. The world's kind of a little bit of a vitriolic place, and so it's easy to be negative and pessimistic. But from my perspective, and there's a lot of things about healthcare that don't work well.
Right.
The delays don't work well. If you're waiting on a pathology report and think you might have cancer, that wait is the longest wait in the world. I won't tell you how old she is, but one of my favorite aunts, who has a few years on her, went to her doctor's office recently and had to complete a new electronic medical record on a tablet. She's very savvy. She's very cool. And she did it, and she effectively tossed it on the counter because it was so terrible. And she said, y'all need an app for that.
Oh, how funny.
So we're dealing with all these electronic medical records, the pros and cons of that.
Right.
So now when you go to your doctor, he or she's very often sitting typing.
That's right.
While he or she's talking to you.
Yes.
Which is not what most patients had in mind.
Exactly.
And not what most doctors had
in mind. The eye-to-eye contact is no longer there.
So there's a lot of stuff about healthcare that's aggravating, and that's before you get to the cost. What's terrific about it, though, I think, is this. There are still an amazing number of really bright students who go into it. I probably today couldn't get into what I got into because the competition so much. I know, for instance, that in the most recent dental school class, because dental health is important to overall health, most recent dental school class in Memphis is 100 students, and they had 1,600 applicants.
Wow.
So you got really good students. Mm-hmm. So you have smart people who are doing this. We have the best drugs we've ever had.
Right.
Aggravatingly too expensive.
For sure.
Terrific.
Yes.
We have fabulous progress on things like the human genome.
Mm-hmm.
We get more and more close to really good personalized medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Not here's a chemotherapeutic plan that works for most people with your cancer.
Right.
But here's an oncological plan that's specifically tailored to Kathy Ackerman's specific problem.
Right.
And so I think the future of healthcare is really bright in terms of how well we're going to do as patients.
Right.
And how long we're going to live if we don't kill ourselves
with
smoking and obesity and other things that we self-inflict.
Right.
Which is still a huge problem. So I'm really bullish.
That's great.
About the future of healthcare.
That's great to hear.
And I will tell you, in this community in Knoxville and in Tennessee, we have really good healthcare. You know, we work all over the country. We see it lots of places. It's not perfect everywhere. It's not perfect anywhere probably, but we're really blessed here with good hospitals and good clinicians. And the state's, I think, very blessed. I think the outlying counties have a real challenge, you know, from a small county.
Mm-hmm.
And our local hospital that actually loaned me the money to go to medical school is now just an ER and a nursing home.
Right.
Now, thank goodness for that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is a full-service hospital 10 miles away, so it works.
Mm-hmm.
But my biggest concerns about healthcare right now have to do with cost and accessibility.
Mm-hmm.
I think quality and the incredible progress that's being made about clinical treatments is really, really, really room for all of us to feel good.
Oh, that's exciting. And good to hear from somebody who's right in the middle of it all day, every day.
Wonderful.
Lynn, thanks so much for being with us on Sweet Tea and Strategy, and thank you for sharing your thoughts and your wisdom with us. We look forward to continued growth and success for Team Health, and we are so proud to have you as one of Knoxville's most prominent corporate leaders.
Thanks. I'm very pleased to be included in this. Thank you.
Thank you.